Open the House Committee on Health Care. Call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this April 1st. And make a couple of announcements first. We are going to work neither of the two work sessions scheduled. We'll carry both of them over till Monday. We're having trouble. Carrying both over till Friday. We're having trouble getting all the amendments that are coming flying at us from different directions, some of which do one thing and some of which do the other, and some of which people have seen for weeks and all of a sudden discovered they can't tolerate. But maybe Friday. But in the meantime, we're going to carry it over till Friday. So I'm not going to... Do I have to open the work session to carry them over?
No.
Okay. We have a few witnesses, a couple of witnesses on 3310. So we'll take 3300 first, to clear the deck. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3300. Sandy, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3300 was introduced at the request of Representative Lively. It requires primary care physicians to serve a specified percentage of medical assistance recipients in order to contract with the Public Employees Benefit Board or the Oregon Educators Benefit Board to provide medical care. Requires the Oregon Health Authority to calculate the percentage for each county and report that information to the boards.
And in case we don't have room in the room for people who are in overflow, who are the next three, please, the next panel?
Oh, after 3300,
yep.
It is, okay, Debbie came up, and then we have Alan Yordy, Jane Conley, and Jenny Olam.
And that's all of this.
That is.
Yep, okay. Representative Lively, please kick
Thank
it off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Lively. I'm House District 12 State Representative. Thank you for this opportunity to address House Bill 3300. For me, this journey that has led to this particular bill goes back a decade or longer. I have served in Lane County on a group called 100% Access, and so it goes back to the work we've all been doing, and certainly since I've been in the legislature, we've been doing about providing access to people to ongoing health care. And during all of that time, the continuing issue has been, in many cases, access, even if they have insurance, which we've come a long ways with providing, access because of the lack of enough providers, especially family practice providers. So as we looked at those issues back in June of 2014, Trillium had a conference dealing with state of the delivery system, and in that particular conference that I had the privilege of participating to, there was a lot of discussion about providers and having enough providers, and people here have heard the stories previously about the lack of providers specifically in Lane County, but certainly we know throughout the state of Oregon that there's limited. During that conversation, one of the things that we discussed and talked about was the impact on providers given the payers and what the payer mix was and how that could influence or not influence providers, and specifically those providers that have a heavy burden with having Medicaid patients in that and not a lot of other private payers. So out of those conversations came this concept. And especially came the concept when in subsequent sessions we've moved towards PEB and OEB being part of the CCOs moving on in to try to address the fact that there needed to be some spread of those payers, meaning that in any particular practice there should be kind of a balance of who the payers are, both those payers from a standpoint of Medicaid and Medicare, and also payers from private insurance. And in this case, this new class of potential customers, which are in many cases the better payer, that practices would have access to all of those, and there'd be some balance within practices so that those people could continue to practice. So this bill is an intent to try to address that so that there's some guidelines as to if people are going to accept specifically PEB or OEB, that they also would have some percentage of the other types of payers, specifically Medicaid or OHP, in their clientele. And so that's the reason we've put the bill before you to try to address what I see as a equity issue, parity issue amongst Medicaid payments, and we've got several people here that will talk specifically about the issues. Thank you.
So Chair Green.
Senator Farr.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Debbie Farr. I am with Trillium Community Health Plan in Lane County. And as you know, because we've talked about this before, access for OHP members to a health plan doesn't always mean access to care. Specifically, primary care in Lane County has been very challenging. At the end of 2013, we had about 57,000 members. In 2014, in just a matter of months, we bumped up to nearly 85,000, and at one point had 9,000 members we could not assign to a primary care provider. So we employed a number of strategies to be able to work with our practices, give them an additional per member per month cash payment, grants to clinics so that they could expand, as well as giving the county $900,000 to open a community health center, which they were able to open in 6 months and take 6,000 of those members. So by the end of 2014, we had assigned nearly all of those 9,000 members. But unfortunately, because at one point we had so many unassigned, we had to close our plan to New Oregon Health Plan medical members. And as of February 1st of this year, they were all assigned to Trillium. So we have about 12,000 members that we're in the process of assigning, and we're coming up against many of the same challenges. What we have noticed is there are a number of providers that take a large percentage of Oregon Health Plan members. You're going to hear from some of those today, and there are others that take very few. So we look at this as a Medicaid parity issue. We support it. We want to be sure that we have access, true access, for Oregon Health Plan members to care. Any questions?
Yes, Representative Mueller.
What do you think is the main reason why some providers don't see this patient population?
Well, there's a variety of reasons. It doesn't pay quite as well as commercial insurance.
So what's the underlying problem that we're trying to solve?
Well, really what it is true parity. So while some primary care providers do accept a very small percentage of Oregon Health Plan members, there are other providers that accept quite a few. And Trillium has really gone over and above to provide additional per member per month payments. We have a quality pool through the state. So you're going to hear from a practice manager who's really going to talk about how they've made that work to their benefit.
But my question was, what's the cause of why providers aren't seeing these patients? And your answer was payment. So why don't we solve the underlying problem instead of doing a workaround?
Well, part of the problem is that we're restricted by Medicaid payments by the Medicare upper payment limit. So, I mean, it's in some instances really difficult to increase the amount of payment. And it's going to turn out that when we put PEB into the same CCOs, the PEB members are going to, the physicians seeing PEB members will get a higher pay, a higher reimbursement than seeing Medicaid members in the same CCO. I mean, it is a problem. So how we get to that basic problem, I think, is one we need to trigger.
But we still pay below Medicare rates.
We pay basically the Medicare rates are the upper limit we can pay.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. Well, are you done?
Yeah.
Yep. Senator Wyden.
The question is, though, I mean, when we start looking at what we pay per RVU to doctors, we're one of the lowest in the nation at Medicaid reimbursement rates. So I wonder if this body, I mean, to get at the point that they're after, if we shouldn't be reimbursing the same as Medicare.
Do you have data on that? I'd be really interested in seeing that.
Well,
that we're among the lowest.
We're among the lowest, certainly in Medicare. That's well documented.
That's a different issue. Yeah,
yeah, but
that's the Medicare reimbursement, not the
Medicaid's
payment.
Lower than
if it's pegged to if Medicaid's some way pegged to Medicare in this state, then it's going to translate through to that program also.
I have not seen the data. It may be true. I have not seen the data that shows we are among the lowest in the country in Medicaid payments.
I don't know
we are in Medicare.
Medicare certainly are.
Absolutely. But that represents the upper limit, not the lower limit. Okay, would you call the next panel, please?
Yes, we have Alan Yorty and Jane Connolly.
That's your three?
She asked to be withdrawn. Mr. Yorty can
okay,
address
great.
Her issues.
good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Alan Yorty, and I'm the President and Chief Mission Officer for Peace Health. And we operate 4 hospitals, 9 medical clinics, and a variety of other services in Lane County with about 6,000 employees there. So it gives you kind of a perspective. Also, what I'm going to share with you today grows out of some of our experience in Southwest Washington, where we have an imbalance of providers. In one case, a provider has 33% of the primary care physicians and takes 2% of the Medicaid, with a corresponding percentage of the public employees there. And I think Representative Lively's bill comes out of the concern that if everybody takes a corresponding and representative share of each type of patient that I'll talk about here in just a moment, then the system works. Let me just go through a couple of basic facts that drive this. By the way, you have written testimony, and I'm not going to bother reading that, so I'm just going to highlight a few items from this, and then I'll open to questions. Oregon, the state of Oregon, covers approximately 40% of health care in the state. Between PEB, OEB, and Medicaid, it's a large percentage. And as Debbie mentioned, in Lane County, we've seen almost a doubling of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Exactly the right thing to happen, taking care of some of our most vulnerable citizens, and yet it does create a new dynamic that we've not seen before. And for Peace Health, it's a dynamic of having gone from serving 12 to 14, 15% of the total base being Medicaid to now well over 22% and climbing. So it's a big difference. In the written testimony, I'll just highlight the payment issues that Representative Buehler just mentioned. Of course, OEB and PEB are reimbursed at what are essentially commercial rates, which are higher rates. Then there's Medicare, which from our perspective represents payments that are just slightly below cost. Used to be slightly above cost, now they're slightly below. And then there's Medicaid, and we get reimbursed when everything is all said and done at approximately 70 cents for every dollar of our cost. So, in essence, there is a cross-subsidy between commercial clients, patients, and Medicaid. And that's been the dynamic for many, many years, and that's the reason this bill, I think, is so important. If we want the system to work, it will work. Without completely reengineering the system, as long as everybody shares in their respective portion of each patient type. As I mentioned, the growth in Medicaid has been significant, and accompanied with that, we've seen this in many places where we serve, is a shifting dynamic of business models of providers. And it's not surprising. As Medicaid increases, and it's true for both physicians and hospitals, we get paid less than the cost of doing business. But as that occurs, for survival, some groups are having to say, well, we'll take commercial, we'll take some Medicare, but we're going to limit or altogether eliminate our Medicaid clientele. And that's part of the reason we're seeing a healthy insured group in Medicaid, but not necessarily always access in Medicaid. And so that's the issue that we're really trying to work at. I wish there were money to pay, you know, Medicare or Medicare plus rates for Medicaid, but just judging from what we dealt with in education yesterday with the budget, it doesn't look like there's going to be money to do that in the state's budget. Now, let me just address 3300 briefly. It is not a requirement. It does not establish a requirement that providers must take state employees or must take Medicaid. But what it essentially says is for those who decide to take state employees in their patient panel, the state must also set some criteria to take Medicaid as well. So I want to be clear that there is a choice involved here, but it does ask the state to set up some quid pro quo relationships between OEB, PEB, and Medicaid service. In other words, take that 40% of the state clients and establish some criteria for all of us as providers, would apply to everybody even-handedly for how we accept and we take Medicaid. Finally, I will just close with a comment here. We have experienced in healthcare this idea of cost shifting for many years. It's not a new idea. It's part of the way the healthcare system thrives. And while under our community benefit, we've seen, under the Affordable Care Act, charity and bad debt decline, we have seen the corresponding discount between cost and payment on Medicaid rise, and rise rather significantly. So the gains that have been made in charity and bad debt have been significantly offset by the shortfalls in the payments of Medicaid as we try to serve everybody. And that's just the dynamic that has continued to exist. So this bill is really about maintaining access to everyone, ensuring not only that they have an insurance card or a Medicaid card, but ensuring that they have access to primary care and other services. And with that, I'd close. Thank you, and would take any questions you might have.
Let's have the next witness first.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here. My name is Jane Conley. I've been the practice administrator at Springfield Family Physicians for 7 years in Lane County. Springfield Family Physicians has long established private primary care practice, about 25 or 30 years. We became a Tier 3 medical home in 2011, currently applied for the 3-star status through the OHA. The history of our practice is that it has always strived to be good community partners, and so for us, that means that our patient base reflects the demographic of the community in which we work and live. In 2013, we had about 1,800 Medicare patients, represented about 18% of our practice. As you all know, in 2014, there was a huge influx of OHP patients, and our primary care shortage continued and got worse. So it was the perfect storm. And because we were acutely aware of this and were also successful in attracting a couple of new providers to our practice, in early 2014, we took on 1,500 more Orphan Health Plan patients. As the year progressed and the problem worsened, we took advantage of some incentives Trillium provided and took on 2,500 more Oregon Health Plan patients later in 2014 for a total of 4,000 in the year. In our second batch, we specifically took on hundreds of patients who had been designated as severely persistently mentally ill. So a high needs, complex group of patients. Currently, in our particular practice, our demographic, we are at about 35% Medicaid OHP patients. Interestingly enough for us, we found that taking on chunks of OHP patients in batches like this has forced us to be a better practice. It's forced us to develop team-based care approaches. It's forced us to look at how we do business and marshal all of our resources to do a better job for these patients, and all of our patients have benefited. We actually believe it's strengthened our practice to do this. I believe payment strategy will drive change. So I speak only from a primary care perspective. I don't run a large multi-specialty organization and hospital system. But from my perspective, payment will drive change. Trillium provides payment in a three-part method, as I'm sure most or all of you know. The per member per month allows us to hire staff that allow us to develop a team-based approach. Nurse care managers, a second medical assistant for all of our physicians, pays us up front to do those things and allows us to take care of a bigger village. The modest fee for service pays us when we do things, but it doesn't overly reward us for doing. The key driver that I think will revolutionize our industry is the pay-for-performance part of it, the bonus for doing a good job and being held accountable for doing a good job. And so the bonus pools that accumulate for our ability to prove that we have actually done a good job are teaching us to think differently. I can speak for myself, and I know that it's reflected in the physicians that I work with. We have a long history of being taught that we get paid for taking care of sick people. It takes a lot to turn the bus around and try to figure out how we get reimbursed for keeping people well. So we support Medicaid parity for any providers that accept state-funded insurance. With the current shortage of primary care, from my vantage point, it's easy for primary care providers to carve out a practice that has only the best-paying contracts in it. There's plenty of patients for all. And so those of us who have stepped up and accepted additional Oregon Health Plan patients who happen to be a crowd that has more complex medical and social needs than commercially insured patients, it doesn't seem fair to us that some providers would be able to take the best paying insurance carriers and ignore the most vulnerable citizens in the community who are also covered by state insurance.
Thank you. Questions to this panel?
Widener and then Bueller.
Representative Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Bueller.
I understand where you're getting here, but aren't there different practices that just have different business models and the way they operate and everything, and you're wanting them all to be like you rather than let them practice the way that they want to provide a service for a certain group of people?
May I answer that?
Sure.
My agenda would be, if you take state insurance, you take all state insurance. So again, as I heard Mr. Yorty say, it's about a choice. If we choose to take a PEB contract that pays very well, we should shoulder some responsibility for the state contracts that don't pay so well.
And Representative Widener and members of the committee, I would really echo that, in that what we're talking about is a healthcare system that serves all providers. And to the degree that there are fewer and fewer providers that serve all state employees, then it will be harder for those left at the Medicaid payment rates to take care of those folks. So this is one mechanism. You know, if we were going to design a system today in healthcare, what we'd probably do is take all the money that the state spends, and doesn't matter whether it's PEB, OEB, or Medicaid, put it in the bucket and say, okay, there's a common
payment. No, I take all the money anybody spends.
Right, and there'd be a common payment rate. That would be the ideal world, but we're not in that world. And so this is the step to get us to something, hopefully, that would be an improvement down the road.
May I follow up?
Briefly, yeah. We have a few people who want to testify, like everybody else in the room and in the hallway.
Okay. Follow up real quick, but the other people shouldn't be in this committee. They should be in energy and environment, but that's another subject.
We'll find out after the testimony, won't we?
I guess I wonder if the state employees, because OEB's a big expense for a lot of our school districts and everything for that. It's been shown I'm on PEB. I hate the way they reimburse. I have more issues with PEB and dealing with PEB than any insurance company I've ever dealt with in my entire life. So I wonder if all state employees, including us, shouldn't be off the exchange or something like that, where we just buy our own plan would make more sense and just get rid of those two.
You can buy insurance on your own. You can opt out of PEB.
Mm-hmm. So,
well, Representative Widener, let me just pick up on that idea, because I think you heard in both of our testimony sort of the beginnings of this new world, where there is some level of payment for actually doing the right thing and putting us as providers at some level of risk for doing the right thing. Yeah. And I think the whole goal of the CCO and of PEB and OEB is to get us into that world where the incentive is not to do a lot of things, but to do the right things. And so I would hope that PEB and OEB would take some of the early lessons from the CCOs and start to migrate those into those payment systems as well, because I think we would save significant dollars and we would probably end up with better care.
Representative Bueller.
Thanks for your testimony and bringing this important problem to light. Why do you think there's such a shortage of primary care physicians in the state of Oregon?
You want me to take that one?
Sure.
Okay, Representative Bueller, and members of the committee. There's probably many factors that contribute to that. And I would say some of it is history. As you know, OHSU, probably more than any other institution, certainly on the West Coast, has done more to train primary care providers. And yet, we have had a bolus of new patients and therefore new...
But there's a problem with shortage before the bolus of...
There was, but not nearly as significant as we're seeing now because we've got new patients who need more service. So there's some issue around payment. There's some issue around...
But what would this do with regards to payment for an average primary care physician? Would it increase it or lower it, an average primary care physician?
It depends practice by practice. When you've seen one practice, you've probably seen one example. It depends whether that primary care office accepts all patients.
In general,
if they have, it might actually increase payment a bit. If they have not accepted Medicaid in the past, it might decrease it some.
I think it's...
But that's my colleague is certainly better able to deal with that than I am.
Let's go on if we can.
Let me just one follow-up.
Go ahead.
So how are physicians in Peace Health paid?
They are paid. They have multiple factors in payment. The first is that they're paid for a combination of both the numbers of RVUs and the numbers of patients in their panel. So it's a combination of the two. And the third is a risk-reward payment for quality, performing quality service. For instance, we have metrics around care of diabetics, and that goes into a variable component that ranges between 5 and 10%.
Is there cost shifting between other services provided in Peace Health and physician reimbursement?
In other words, does it go beyond just physician payment?
Is there, how do you cover the payments to physicians? You have a big pot of money at Peace Health.
Right.
So payments, if you come up short with regards to physician reimbursement, how's that?
If you come up short, it comes out of whatever other monies there are available to pay physicians.
So would a typical private practice have that ability to cost shift within their organization to cover a salary shortfall?
It depends on what other revenue the practice has. For instance, if they have ancillary services, the answer would be probably there's some ability to shift.
Safe to say you have much more ability to do that than a typical physician practice.
That is correct. Larger organizations would typically have more capacity than smaller organizations.
So you'd be able to accommodate this much easier than a typical medical practice.
I don't think I'd characterize it that way, but larger organizations do have more capacity to spread cost.
Thank you.
That's correct. Thanks.
President Hayden?
Chair Greenlick, thank you. Keep brief. So I appreciate the approach. This is one approach. Another approach would be to take the step, maybe a little bolder, maybe politically a little more difficult, but to put the PEB and OEB contracts under the CCOs and then make a concerted effort at the state to raise primary care residency slots by 25%. I think that would, or actual 25 slots. I think we are working on some of that, and I think it's on all of those. And I think there's an alternative approach that we could take more globally here that could be successful without impacting the individual practitioner. So just encourage you to keep an open mind to two sides on the conversation.
Mm-hmm. But this is about putting PEB into CCOs. That's what this is the response to.
An answer, Representative Hayden?
Well, Representative Hayden. I would say that it takes all of those. I mean, I think what I see is the same thing I'm sure everybody sees. We have a huge crisis of primary care shortage in this country and in this state. It's in the medical profession, it's a difficult profession that is low reimbursement. And so I think it's multifactorial. It's people coming out of school with $300,000 worth of debt, making less than anybody else in the profession. And so there's got to be, I see no solution except over the next few years, there has to be a natural shifting of reimbursement towards primary care. And when that happens, it's away from something else.
Right.
Follow up.
So, last question.
So I appreciate that, and the CCO is a new model to Oregon, and it needs time to develop, and I think it is developing, and to Chair Greenlich's point that, yes, in part we're talking about putting the state programs under the CCO, but you're also talking about individual healthcare providers in their practice having to follow a state regulation or mandate that they may or may not want to do, and I think working with a stick is much more difficult than working with a carrot.
I see that as both a carrot and a stick. A good contract and take some of the less lucrative ones.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Greenlich, members of the committee.
Thank you.
Revisit this topic before we're done.
Thank you.
I close the public hearing. House Bill 3100.
3300, right?
Yes.
House Bill 3300. Close the public hearing. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3300. I got this right. I just want to make a brief comment on this relative to what Representative Widener mentioned just a bit ago. Senator Denbro and I have been working on the question of diesel particulate for some time, and there is a bill moving in the Senate, or in the Senate, one hopes moving in the Senate, and this bill here. This bill, you are correct, ultimately would need to go to energy and environment before it would move forward. But the importance of this hearing and what I've asked the witnesses to focus on is the issue of the health effects of diesel particulate pollution, because I think the Environmental and Energy Committee wants us to provide some policy insight before they deal with this as a purely environmental issue rather than as a health issue. So the hearing today, and I'm sure the witnesses here have been instructed that way, to focus on the question of the health effects. This is the Healthcare Committee, and we think that's most important. The other thing is we have an hour and 10 minutes. We have to be out of here by 2:45. So I'm going to ask you all to be relatively brief. Say what you need to say. Make sure you cover the issues you need to cover, but no more than that. And if you've heard it three times already, you don't need to repeat it, because if you've heard it three times, you can assume we've heard it at least once, and that would be be very useful. So, Madam Administrator, what do we have in front of us, and would you call the first panel?
And this is our four, and this is our people that are opposed. So we'll be one to deal with. House Bill 3310 requires the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt rules relating to standards and programs for on-road and non-road diesel engines no later than January 1, 2020. And some of these folks I don't see in the room, but I'm going to call them. Tricia Tillman?
Is Mary coming up?
Oh, you're here for Tricia? Okay, thank you. Susan Katz?
She's here.
Please. The Deputy State Epidemiologist, Bruce, please. Good deal. Yes. There we go.
I'm going to complain.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on this very important piece of legislation. My name is Jay Douglas, and I serve as the Environmental Health Director for Multnomah County Health Department, and I'm here to express my support for this bill. Specifically related to the health issues of diesel particulate, we know that diesel exhaust is a known carcinogen. It causes not only cancer, it increases the risk of heart attack, stroke, and cardiovascular disease, and it exacerbates asthma and can lead to low birth weight and preterm birth. Especially in terms of child health, we know that early impacts, early insults are particularly concerning for children, given the huge influence on the course that those impacts can have across the lifespan. And children are especially vulnerable because they're still in developmental phase as they breathe and grow. They average twice the amount of air per pound as adults. So children are not just little adults. They're at key developmental stages, and these environmental impacts are particularly concerning. In Multnomah in particular, we have the fourth highest measured level of diesel pollution of any one of the 3,100 U.S. counties that have been monitored. So we are experiencing a very significant impact from diesel particulate. In some areas, like near transportation corridors and rail yards, levels of diesel pollution can exceed 10 times the benchmark set by the Oregon standards. While there's no safe levels of this air pollution in our county, there are particularly bad areas, and they tend to be areas where communities of color reside. So for us, this is very much an environmental justice issue. Last year, our department conducted a study of racial and ethnic health disparities, and we found that communities of color are exposed to levels of diesel pollution 2 to 3 times the levels of their white counterparts. Fortunately, there are solutions such as this one. The majority of diesel emissions in Oregon do come from heavy-duty trucks and construction equipment, but because of the federal regulations, the newer engines that are fitted with pollution controls, those requirements only apply to new engines, and they do reduce these emissions by up to 99%. So there is the technology result help on the way. And as a state, we have to deal with what's already in place and the potential that, as California has made its changes, that Oregon is very likely to become a dumping ground for old and dirty engines. And every year that we don't act on this issue, our communities are increasingly impacted by exposure to these levels of diesel pollution. We're very happy to support this bill, and I'm here to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Susan Katz. I'm a retired behavioral pediatrician and the head of the board president of the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and head of the Environmental Work Group. Our mission is to help protect our environment from the gravest threats to human health. As a physician trained in chemistry, pediatrics, and child psychiatry, I have become increasingly concerned about the robust evidence for harmful health effects of diesel exhaust. For this reason, I strongly support House Bill 3310. Diesel exhaust contains at least 40 toxic air pollutants, and it's the most deadly component of traffic-related air pollution. It's estimated to account for 90% of airborne particle-bound polyaromatic hydrocarbons. It's the most widespread airborne threat, heavily implicated, we know, in cardiovascular, pulmonary health problems. But more recently, there's very good evidence for its involvement in the increase of neurodevelopmental and neurodegenerative diseases, such as ADHD, autism, and Alzheimer's disease. Because the brain continues to develop in children and infants as well as the developing fetus, they're the most susceptible to these pollutants because of exposures at critical windows of development. The pollutants we talk about are the PM2.5 particles, a criteria pollutant measured by EPA rules. It's a surrogate in some studies for diesel pollution. These act as sponges. They absorb other volatile toxicants in the air, and they carry them deep into the lungs where they're small enough that they can go directly into the bloodstream. The polyaromatic hydrocarbons come from incomplete combustion of hydrocarbons. They come from diesel, gasoline, oil, wood, garbage, and coal. And those are the things that are picked up by the PM2.5s and smaller. Finally, recently, there's been a lot of emphasis on ultrafine particles, which are less than 100 nanometers in size. These can enter the bloodstream directly from the lungs, but also as they are inhaled, they can go directly into the brain. A postulated mechanism of these neurodevelopmental effects is that these substances act as inflammatory agents in the brain, causing disruption of normal activities, especially as the brain is formed during critical windows of exposure. Thus, the formation of normal brain architecture is disrupted early in life, causing dysfunction and disorder later in life. It's clear to me that the reduction of diesel exhaust from trucks, outdated school bus engines, and other sources will greatly benefit the health of Oregonians, especially our children, as well as our elderly population. I urge you to consider these health benefits seriously in your deliberations about the bills.
Thank you.
Any questions? I have references.
Oh, we need references.
You read them?
Absolutely.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Gutilius, and I'm the Deputy State Epidemiologist with the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here to give some additional information about the impact of diesel exhaust on human health. Thank you for having me here today. You've heard, frankly, a great deal of what I would have been telling you as well, but there are a few things maybe to add to this. Which is that particulate matter is well established as a cause of heart disease and pulmonary disease, and consistently has been shown to increase hospitalizations and deaths from those causes when PM2.5 levels rise. So the thing to know about that is that those effects are seen both in the short term and in the long term. So in terms of short term exposure, you're talking about exposure that can be from a day to 3 days, and that's enough to see increases in the number of people who are hospitalized with heart attacks and with congestive heart failure, as well as with pulmonary symptoms. And the longer the exposure, the more effect you see. So it's not surprising, but there's actually a dose-response relationship to this. As the concentration of particulate matter goes up, more people are admitted to the hospital, more people have disease. And the longer they're exposed, the same is true. So I just add that to what my colleagues here have said previously, and also again to note that the World Health Organization does characterize diesel exhaust as a known human carcinogen with strongest links specifically to lung cancer, and that's been seen among people who work around diesel equipment for on an ongoing basis. So that's really what I wanted to add to what my colleagues have said. I'm certainly happy to answer any questions you have at this time.
Any questions?
Hayden.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you for your Chair Greenlick. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I have a few questions or comments here. This is from the U.S. Department of Human Services, Public Health Services Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry. They have conducted a lot of review for the potential effects of fuel oils on human health. A summation of that is the diesel fuel, when inhaled in high enough concentrations, may cause hematological abnormalities that lead to bleeding and increased blood pressure. People who are most likely to be exposed to high concentrations high enough concentrations to cause human health are refinery workers. Oregon is not a home to a refinery. Other human effects are likely to occur when people intentionally expose themselves to fuel on a regular basis, like cooking stoves, using a fuel oil as a thinner contact to the skin, or ingesting it. They also conclude that there have not been studies on the effects of a policy change in diesel standards on human effects. So a lot of what we're hearing, good studies, parts per million, but I don't think that we have, or at least I haven't been able to find research on the effect of the policy change to affect that. So my question to you is, if a whole house were to burn up, or a whole community were to burn up with their garage and their car in there, would that be a significant effect or a toxic effect?
Well, first of all, I think you're talking about diesel fuel in the thing you read from the ATDSR, but we're talking about burnt diesel fuel. We're talking about what happens when you burn it in a diesel engine. It's different from a refinery worker who breathes it. So I think we're talking apples and oranges.
I'm actually talking about when a whole house or community, the whole structure, burns to the ground.
I would have no idea.
Clarification. Are you asking at the time that structure burned with the vehicle in it, at that time, as it was burning, you're talking about the exhaust that's coming off of that structure fire?
Mm-hmm.
Are you asking, would that cause health impacts?
Right.
Might that cause health
yes.
impacts? Well, Dr. Gutilis, you can take it or I can.
Certainly. So, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, when there's particulate matter emitted from different sources, different things that burn, certainly in the short term, we talk about this with forest fires, right? When we have forest fires that occur, we see PM 2.5 levels that go up for some period of time with
2.5 relates to the size of the
particle. I'm sorry,
particle.
Yes, I should have described that. So that's really, it's a fine particle, so it's a very small particle that can get down deep into your lungs. So that sort of particle is released for instance, in forest fires, and would have an effect on people who are vulnerable to the cardiovascular effects from that sort of exposure for the duration that it occurs. So it's not necessarily that the PM 2.5 that comes from a diesel exhaust engine is different from that PM 2.5. It might be, actually, but it's not necessarily that it is. I think the issue when we talk about exposure to diesel exhaust is the extent to which it's ongoing exposure that people who live close to roadways are going to be exposed, as I was discussing, over a matter of years, and that the concentrations that they are exposed to, as opposed to the example you give where there's a finite time during which this would be happening, the structure burns down, the PM 2.5 goes down and goes away. If people are living near roadways where this is an ongoing exposure and they have ongoing exposure to higher levels, that's going to put them at increased risk on an ongoing basis.
But the question he asked, and it'd be interesting to follow up, is as a result of policy changes, say the California standards, has there been any studies on the effect of, say, hospitalization in California from the time they changed the standards? Or is it too new to assess that?
Chair Greenlick, members
of the question. You're getting to
Thank you.
I'm not familiar with any epidemiological study that's taken place yet, but I think it's fair to say that there hasn't been enough time yet since the policy change has been in place that you would see whole-scale changes in the epidemiology. You might see it in areas where, it could be because they're looking at a phased-in approach where you're getting better compliance or where there's been particularly bad air quality, you might see some, but across the board, California compared with other states, I'm not aware of a particular study at this point.
Follow-up?
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. So are you familiar with thank you for the conversation about the forest fires, and I would kind of disagree with the fact that that's an event base, because the federal government just has moved our fire season to 6 months in Oregon. We can see with our weather that that's becoming a continual longer and longer season. It used to be a three-month season. Now it's a six-month season. People are gearing up. So there's a policy and procedure in place called the TIMCO 450 FXL with a ProMac BT52. Are you familiar with what that is?
You just made that up.
I didn't make that up. What that is it is a very appropriate machine for this bill, and what that machine does, that's called a TIMCO, and what that machine does is it goes out and it fights fire, and it destroys material so that it doesn't get burned for this 6 months, and so that people, particularly children with asthma, aren't affected, like you talked about with forest fire, so that they aren't affected by that. And the small amount of fuel in these very efficient engines is diesel. But I would encourage you to include in your studies the effects, the good effects that diesel engines actually bring when they fight these fires and when they go out there and they reduce the amount of poor air quality in our communities through actually stopping forest fires or controlling that. So,
but the issue isn't whether diesel is good or bad. The issue is whether old-style diesel engines that pollute compared to newer diesel engines that don't pollute. That's what this bill is about. It's not to do away with diesel engines. It's to move us towards cleaner diesel engines that you can essentially breathe the exhaust out of those new engines in terms of how pure they are.
Your machine's probably got the new thing.
Hopefully. But the fact is that if you're going to integrate this in, most of the machines that are out there currently fighting these forest fires have the older model engines in them, and so you just you need to balance that with, if we put this standard in right now, how much more effect would there be from increase in burnage from forest fires versus not using the little amount in that diesel engine?
So I think anybody would say go ahead and use it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, let's get to the next panel, please. Thank you very much. You might hang in case we get any more epidemiological questions. That would be.
Okay, this is. Is it Mary Pavito? Mary Pavito?
Yeah, Pavito.
Mary Pavito. John Dunlap and Dale Feik, F-E-I-K. Feik.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I think as they're coming up, to follow up on what Representative Hayden was saying, if we put a timeline and we're changing the standard because we have clean diesel technology that's coming from Daimler right here locally, that those machines are going to get old and wear out and be replaced by these new diesel engines without just slamming it and having a huge effect on industry.
Part of the fear is we have an unlimited supply of bad diesel moving out of California into Oregon as their standards get higher and higher.
Dumping it.
So it isn't the wearing out of the ones that are here now that's the big concern. The big concern is every dirty diesel engine in California is going to end up in Oregon pretty soon.
I wish we had that kind of industry going on here.
I wish so, too. Any order. Just make sure you introduce yourself as you start.
Thank you, Chair Greenluck, and all the members of the committee. My name is Mary Pivato, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of 3310 today. I am the founder and president of an organization called Neighbors for Clean Air. It was founded by Oregon parents and communities who seek to protect our children's health from the dangerous air toxics that are not adequately regulated through federal and state regulations or laws. In fact, diesel emissions alone are responsible for 460...
Mary, can you excuse us this moment? Let's call the next two panels so people know the order they'll be coming up in. Do you want to do that?
Yeah, and it'll just be Bob Russell, Larry Gesher, and Jay Bozovich.
Will be next, and the one after that?
Will be Casey Klosterman, Shelley Boshart.
That's why I have her do it rather than
right.
Someone
and I'm not doing a really good job. Joe Esmonde.
Good. I'm sorry, Mary. Sorry to interrupt.
No problem at all.
There are people in the over. We want to make sure they know.
Very important topic. So, in fact, diesel emissions do represent a significant public health problem, attributed to 460 deaths a year in our state. And that costs Oregon $3.5 billion a year due to the lost work, the hospitalization, and the other costs of treatment. But unlike water pollution in our state, this air pollution, despite the heavy risk, is 100% legal. So often communities have achieved the best outcomes to address air toxics through direct negotiations with sources of air pollution who voluntarily commit to pollution reduction through good neighbor agreements, for example. And I'm very proud of our success as an organization and our My Neighbor's success through negotiations like GNAs with ESCO, current conversations with Vigor Industrial and Intel. But this system that puts the responsibility, all the responsibility on private citizens to ensure achievement of true health-based standards for air pollution is deeply flawed and inherently unfair. There's no better example for this than the most significant risk is posed by diesel exhaust. DEQ data says that diesel exhaust is emitted from heavy trucks, heavy-duty trucks, construction equipment, marine vessels and train engines. Its ubiquitous presence as the engine of our economy makes it impossible for individuals to mitigate the exposures on their own. A recent analysis by Multnomah County Health Department says that too often also, in fact, 2 to 3 times more often, the neighborhoods that are most impacted are made up of communities of color. And we know that these same populations, most often African American and Latinos, suffer disproportionately as well from the negative health outcomes most associated with diesel particulate exhaust, that is asthma, heart disease, and cancer. As Oregonians, we like to think we have clean air, yet Oregon is currently the 6th worst state in the nation for diesel pollution today. And without action from our state legislature right now, Oregon's problem will not just not get better, but stands to get significantly worse as more and more engines outlawed in California make their way into our state. This urgency is why Neighbors for Clean Air is joined by Children's First for Oregon, Oregon Pediatrics Association, Oregon Public Health Association, and Opal Environmental Justice, just a few of the dozens of organizations that represent public health, social justice, and environmental concerns, urge you all to pass meaningful legislation this session to address the most dangerous risks of diesel exhaust. HB 3310 represents the most effective way to reduce dangerous diesel exhaust in our state. Oregon needs to act decisively today to ensure that cheap, dirty diesel engines will not be a good business investment in our state. Please move this forward. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is John Dunlap. I'm the former chair of the California Air Resources Board. I served under Pete Wilson and ran the air quality program from 1994 to 1999. I serve on the board of ESW Group, which is a leading diesel emissions control systems maker for heavy and medium-duty diesel, both for on- and off-road equipment. We lead the market for Level 3 and CARB-verified product lines, and we have a manufacturing facilities in both Pennsylvania and San Diego, California. We desired to come today to speak on House Bill 3310 to let you know that if you decide to move forward, we have technology that's ready to go. We have some 8 verified products to cover the full gambit of everything from transit buses, school buses, on- and off-road equipment. And we will use our experience and program success to build upon not just the California experience, but the national experience, and avoid challenges and mistakes. And we aim to strive to be your partner in providing high-performing, cost-effective solution technology for the Oregon market in both on- and off-road diesel. ESW already has the largest sales and service distributor in the Pacific Northwest, located Shetsky, located here, a bus and van line service group located here in Portland. They're serving folks now and poised to grow the commercial market here. I want to be respectful of your admonition to stick to the health effects. We provided a deck here. We have some 25 slides. It should be in background material, written material that you have. But I just wanted to lend my voice to those today to let you know that if you move forward with what I think, and I think you have the construct of a sound regulatory construct on both the 824 bill as well as yours, that you have partners in the private sector that can help this be implemented. We've been very effective. One of the interesting things about this company is it's called Environmental Solutions Worldwide. So we work very closely with those folks that would be regulated by any program, to partner with them, to be transparent with the state, to make sure that any regulatory obligations they have could be met through our technology and any other technologies in the marketplace. So we commend you for your interest in this issue. We want you to know, if you go forward ultimately with this, that you have some private sector partners like us that are willing to help and make this a program that you can be proud of.
Can you tell me how expensive it is, say, to retrofit a school bus, just as an example, your equipment?
I can get you that, and I can get it quickly to you.
Yeah, what's the order of magnitude we're talking
about? It depends oftentimes. I'm not trying to be evasive on it. It depends on the type of bus, the age, what level of equipment you're going to be putting on it. But I'd rather not say, but it's in the neighborhood of $15,000-$20,000 perhaps, depending, and it could be higher than that, but I'll get that number for you.
Okay.
And we also, Mr. Chairman, can provide representative numbers to your agents relative to what's been going on in the marketplace today. But our company is one of several in the marketplace, so it wouldn't be any kind of a monopoly for us or anything like that. And I think your witnesses earlier that followed your admonition to speak on the health effects, I think, covered the playing field fairly well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. From some library? No.
Can we hear from the...
Okay. Well, let's get to surgery. Okay.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm Dale Feek. I'm the chair of the Air Quality Commission Committee of the Washington County Citizen Action Network, and I'm going to try to not cover what's been said. I'm a member of Neighbors for Clean Air, and so I really appreciate what Mary Pivoto has done, and I support everything that she said. I really appreciate John Dunlap here explaining more the technology that's available that can be adopted, so I much appreciate that. I'm also an environmental activist, and I define an activist by as a person who works for the common good without personal gain. And I have nothing to gain based upon my testimony other than the preservation of public health and safety. There is the air monitoring equipment at the next to the Hillsborough Airport. And if there's another reading that's not good, then it could be that area could become a non-attainment area. And that's for particulate matter, PM10 and PM2.5. Now I'm going to skip. Emergency generators for data centers. And Intel is going to be buying a bunch of data. They're really getting into this, and so that's a big deal. Emissions from jets, Intel and Nike and charter jets. I go to the here airport roundtable, and the chair of that says that jets, diesel is the main emission from those jets, diesel. And diesel does have benzene, and benzene is really damaging to bone marrow. And that wasn't mentioned in anybody else's testimony. So I'm going to skip part of what I have down here. Businesses that benefit from diesel emissions need to pay part of the health care costs by retrofitting the old engines or buying newer, much more efficient engines. I only wish that the bill's action would require a tighter timeline for implementation. That's a real criticism of the bill. It's not soon enough, okay? I'm having to skip around here. So there are sources of volatile organic compounds. On-road vehicles by EPA says is 28%. Non-road equipment is 19%. Industrial processes is 11%. That's EPA. The Clean Fuels Program was passed. I think it'll be signed, or it was signed. I participated in those hearings, gave public comment, and it's biodiesel is still part of diesel, and they're going to reduce it just 10% over a certain length of time. So diesel is the critical factor that I hope you are considering. So, again, stop being the place where Washington and California can dump their dirty trucks and diesel engines. Please pass House Bill 3310.
Thank you. Representative Buehler.
Yes, thank you, Chair Greenlee. What's the major cause of emissions fouling our air in the state of Oregon?
Based on the overall, I think diesel emissions would. I'm not sure if we've modeled the entire state. I know in the Portland metro area, diesel emissions represent a significant portion of the highest problematic emissions.
More than dust or wildfires or stoves?
I have not seen a total statewide analysis of all comparisons. I think that, again, in terms of the human exposure and risk, diesel emissions rank very high.
So potentially we could lower emissions by attacking another cause other than just diesel engines.
Well, diesel emissions.
I'll co-sponsor bill with you to outlaw forest fires.
I'm
Mr.
on.
Chair, I have it.
I don't know.
No, I have it. I have it.
But what I'm driving at here is: has any cost-effectiveness analysis been done to see that if our limited capital is best served in cleaning up diesel engines or attacking another cause of dirty air in the state of Oregon? I mean, to me, if we're going to make such a big policy change, a cost-effectiveness study should be done and should be available to us.
Thank you, Chair Greenlock and Representative Bueller, for those questions. I think the toxicity of diesel is really well proven. It actually, diesel is a has 40 toxic compounds attached to the particulate matter.
Not answering my question.
Ultra fine.
You're not answering my question.
Well, I think that the biggest cost to public health. That is the real cost that we're dealing with.
Don't
and the toxicity
I'm just asking
of
for
diesel
is that your opinion or
well
is that
established.
The data? Is that your opinion or is that the data?
Representative Bueller.
Representative Bueller, thank you, Chair Greenlock. That is my understanding of the data that exists for diesel specifically, that we understand the toxicity of diesel is extremely high.
May I answer that?
Sure.
Would you state your question one more time?
I'm just looking for the cost effectiveness of lowering emissions from different sources. So if we're going to commit to, if we really want to move the dial on this, and I think this is an important problem, don't get me wrong, but what's the best way to spend limited resources? Is it cleaning up diesels or cleaning up forest fires, dust on our roads, wood stoves? Has anyone done that work before we make a whole-scale change?
Excuse me. I'm going to go to the bigger issue is to deal with climate change.
Sure.
Because if you really want to make an impact, you got to deal with climate change. Okay, then that comes back to
right.
We're getting away from the
yeah.
issue.
So
I don't want to get into the climate change.
Yeah. So, but your forest fires and all that kind of stuff is the bigger issue. Yeah, but the diesel is important, and you always need to take a look at reducing health costs, health risks.
Sure, and that would come out in a cost-effectiveness study, right?
I think there are cost-effectiveness. It'd be interesting to find out if it's true.
Mr. Chairman, I might be able to shed some light on that. Your DEQ would have an emissions inventory that they use for their regulatory efforts. All states have them. They do some filing with US EPA on progress, et cetera. This pie chart, if you will be able to show you the remaining sources of emission, be easy to get, and then you can look at cost-effective options.
Yeah.
Representative Kammerer?
Thank you. I was intrigued that you had a specific figure of 640 deaths per year in Oregon attributable to diesel. And I guess how do you know that diesel is the culprit, and how accurate is that?
Thank you, Representative Kennemore. Chair Greenlake. The number, and actually it's 460 to clarify, 460. That number is derived from federal data, emissions calculations, emissions factors that EPA provides for exposure on the, so that every.
So it's an extrapolation
of
from the data.
Pound of diesel that is emitted, there are public health figures and numbers attributed to that.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Greenlake, if I understand this bill correctly, this would be a statewide measure, not a regional measure, where you actually have some of the studies that you're talking about. Why would you have an overlay where you haven't studied the whole state if it's geographical areas that you're concerned about?
Thank you, Representative Hayden, for your question. Actually, we understand that 17 counties in Oregon actually exceed the health-based limits of diesel emissions. So we do know this is a statewide problem. There's also an issue because we're talking about the technology that is engine-specific. It would be very, very difficult, I think, to triangulate geographic areas where the engines are operating. But we also know that if anywhere you're close to a high transportation corridor or the freight movement areas, I mean, it's pretty much in any of the large concentrations of population, we have diesel exposure problems.
I'm going to move to the next panel now. We've got a lot of people I'd like to come a long way. I'd like to make sure we hear from them. So would you call the next panel, please?
Again, Bob Russell, Larry Gesher, and Jay Bozovich.
I knocked this over.
There's some far away people.
We have one individual who traveled 100 miles. Everybody else is
Let's make sure they're here.
Yeah.
I can tell I was doing something, can't you?
Please introduce yourself.
Jay Gesher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and thank you for the opportunity.
You guys have an opinion on this?
just a little one, although what I would really like to do is truncate my testimony significantly. It's available on OLIS, and just provide you a few facts, and out of respect for all the people back here that would like to testify.
Right, I think it's important to hear.
I totally agree. Truckers. On my testimony, you'll see a page and a half of initiatives that involve the trucking industry in cleaning up emissions from our diesel engines. We've been working on it for some time, and it has been very effective. A couple things I want to point out to you in particular is the 2007 engines that are operated by the trucking industry today have reduced the particulate matter, including the PM2.5, by about 95%. There was a previous witness that said 99. I've heard 92, so I split the difference at 95. But it is a significant reduction. The 2010 diesel engines reduced the NOx by also about 95%. So the health impacts from modern diesel engines used by the trucking industry are significantly reduced. Matter of fact, there is a very recent Health Effects Institute study that looked at the newer diesel engines and the impact on health. And they concluded that a 2007 diesel engine used by the trucking industry, there is no longer any link between the exhaust and cancer. And they also noted that the 2010 engines, because of the reduction in NOx, have further improvements in public health. And that study just came out late last year, so that's relatively recent. I would also like to point out that based on statistics that Senator Dembro requested for the next hearing, that 72% of the heavy trucks operating in Oregon have 2007 or newer engines.
What percent?
72%. So it's a significant percentage. There's about 318,000 heavy trucks that operate in through the state. The question always remains is, what do you do with the older diesels? The ones before 2007. Well, in 2007, with the support of the Oregon Trucking Associations, this legislature passed House Bill 2172, which was known as the Clean Diesel Bill. And it set up a fund to repower, retrofit, and destroy older diesel engines. Also in that session, Ways and Means transferred $500,000 in federal funds from ODOT to DEQ for that program. To my knowledge, that money has never been transferred. I have repeatedly asked DEQ to put a policy option package in their budget request asking for money for the Clean Diesel Fund. They have told me repeatedly that it is not one of their priorities. And I'm disappointed that we find ourselves here after we've had an opportunity to deal with this and we have neglected it for 8 years.
Hmm. I was on the Transportation Committee that passed that in 2007.
Right.
Regime.
And
what year? 8 years ago, 2007.
You may recall that Margie Hoffman and Lindsay Capps and I were the three that really worked hard to get that bill passed at that time. So I want to contrast that with the state of California, which we're talking about. They have what's called the Carl Moyer Fund. And before they've adopted these regulations, they have poured hundreds and millions of dollars into incentives to help their trucking industry come up to the standards before they implemented the regulations. And on the other hand, we have neglected the opportunity to provide some incentives and help for the trucking industry, not just the trucking industry. The Clean Diesel Fund applies to all diesel engines in the state. I would also like to point out to you that 75% of the freight that's transported in the state is moved by truck. If we have a significant increase in our cost, it will undoubtedly impact Oregon's entire economy. So I would urge you to move with caution. I would suggest that perhaps the best thing to do at this time, particularly since we just came out of the worst recession in history, is to put some money in the Clean Diesel Fund. Let's get take care of some of the older diesels. We're purchasing new trucks. Over time, it will the problem will take care of itself.
Bob, would you send the committee some information on the new diesel fund? As I remember, it had to do with engines built in Oregon.
And it wasn't engines, Mr. Chair, it was not engines built in Oregon. There was an emphasis on dealing with school buses, and there was, and yes, it was restricted to trucking companies that were based in Oregon. So it was dealing with our own. California did the same thing with the Carl Moyer Fund. They were dealing with their own down there. I would like to take just a second to address the dumping of dirty trucks issue. Also, data that ODOT provided to Senator Dembro about 2 weeks ago. In 2015, which we're only partially through that, there have only been four trucks that were registered in California that have been re-registered here in Oregon. That's only a partial year. 2014, there were 48 trucks. 2013, 58 trucks. 2012, 76 trucks. We're talking about 318,000 total trucks. There is absolutely no evidence that there is any dumping of dirty diesels in Oregon. And I would conclude my testimony.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Greenluck and members of the committee. My name is Larry Gesher. I'm the president of HP Civil, located in state in Oregon. We're a heavy highway contractor specialized in bridge construction. We're an emerging small business. We've been in business just over a year. I'm also the president of the Association of General Contractors for the Oregon-Columbia chapter for 2015. My testimony today, I guess I want to concentrate on some of the impacts it would cause to our industry as a result of this bill. Oregon's construction industry is one of the hardest hit industries in the recent recession. The construction industry is just now starting to get back on its feet after going through the steepest downturn since the Great Depression. Construction creates the high-paying middle-class jobs Oregon is desperate for, and we should support the industry rather than burdening it with new regulations. As an example, I recently just bought a 100-ton crane for one of our construction jobs. It's a 1982 crane. We paid $140,000 for the crane. A similar, or I should say almost identical piece of equipment, same capacity, would cost $1.4 million to buy today with a Tier 4 engine in it. There's no way a business like mine could start with that type of burden to get started. To say that we're a dumping grounds, to kind of reiterate what Bob's saying on the heavy off-road equipment, as a construction industry, we don't make money by buying worn-out, broke-down, used equipment. The first thing I intend on doing as soon as I generate more capital is buy newer equipment, because it's reliable, it's efficient. That's how we make our money. We do not make our money by buying old equipment. And so the idea that everybody's going to be wanting to buy old equipment, that's your last resort.
You
that's where you
said
start.
You bought an old crane.
But that's because I just started. You want to give me some loans, I'll go buy some new equipment.
More jobs.
I heard you say you're going to back a timber logging mill to stop forest fires.
Sure.
So I'm not going to go into all of the thing, same stuff, but more or less I'll give you a couple other facts here. It's important to note that diesel engines are responsible for less than 6% of all particulate matter in the U.S., and the U.S. accounts for only 8% of global black carbon emissions. That's according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's 2012 report on black carbon to Congress. Some of the retrofits, it's been stated and testified at the U.S., at the government national level, that the retrofits cause issues with sight vision for operators with some of the different emission filters they put on. And so as a result of that, they're seeing more accidents, more deaths. That's one of our industry's biggest accident-prone areas is visibility from people in heavy pieces of equipment. And now we're putting big stacks on for filters and things that also block the vision. And another note, not all off-road equipment or machines have a retrofit solution due to space constraints. Additionally, retrofits are incredibly expensive, generally costing $100 per horsepower on average. And if you think about our heavy equipment, we typically start at 100 horsepower for our larger piece of equipment and go up from there. And so it's very expensive. Caterpillar has a product line of over 300 machines and can only repower about one-third of them. It's incredibly costly, roughly 240 hours of labor time at $300 an hour is what they estimate with the actual engines. Equates to about $72,000 to actually do a conversion of an engine switchover. And so when we start weighing out putting a new engine into an older piece of equipment, really quickly you get to the point where the value of the piece of equipment is not worth putting the motor into it. And so that's the way out that we always go through when we're going through a piece of older equipment, deciding if we're actually going to upgrade to a newer engine. Incentive programs are already in place in Oregon. As Bob stated, there was already the bill passed. We have not funded it. And I guess AGC is absolutely interested in cleaner air. Our members breathe the same air as everyone else. AGC's core policy supports an incentive-oriented approach that covers the cost of emission reduction equipment or new equipment. Other states, such as Texas, New York, Ohio, have successfully implemented voluntary programs that provide grants and loans for emission-reducing equipment. John Rakowitz with AGC has started the outreach to some of the other states, gathering the data for some of the other incentive programs going on around the U.S. And so he'll be a valuable resource down the road when more issues come up. For all these reasons, for which I have testified, AGC cannot support this bill. More questions than answers are raised with this bill. For the record, we are more than willing to engage in a volunteer-based, well-thought-out incentive program that just does not cost the taxpayers money to push older equipment, older pieces of equipment, to other less progressive states. Thank you.
That's right. We want to move it on. Just keep going. Yes, sir.
Hello.
Into Idaho.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
If I could, just before he finishes up, because I'd like to get something clarified. You talked about buying an older crane and using an older crane. Mm-hmm. I think it's important for the committee to know how often does that equipment run? I mean, you run two or three jobs a year with it, or
cranes typically run? As far as production, we usually get 20 to 30% is operating time out of a day.
Yeah.
So very.
But during seasonal times, too, or is that every day?
Bridge construction, we try not to be seasonal. Obviously, we have fish in Oregon,
so
we have
to
work around fish
windows.
So,
but
yes.
Before the committee, if we can.
On other heavy pieces of equipment, that's definitely true at the earthwork side.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Jay Bozovich, and I am the chair of the Lane County Board of Commissioners. And as such, I'm also the chair of the Board of Health, and I'm also the commissioner's representative to the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority. And we did not have a chance to vote on this specific bill as a board, so I'm here as an individual commissioner in opposition to the bill, although we did pass a set of principles, one of which is to oppose all unfunded mandates, which this bill is. And by that, I mean this bill has been estimated for Lane County to cost us about $6 million to comply with. And most of that $6 million comes out of our road fund, where most of our large diesel engines are sitting. And if you're aware, right now Lane County is trying to pass a vehicle registration fee to close a $9 million a year annual deficit in our road fund. Lane County maintains over 1,400 miles of roadways. We have a $6 billion road asset we maintain. And this will take away our ability to maintain that, which is a safety issue. And as vehicle deaths and injuries from accidents are a leading cause of premature death in Oregon, that's where this ties. Passage of this bill will hurt our ability to maintain our roads in a safe condition. So there is a trade-off in passing this bill and advancing that cost of vehicle replacement for counties, for cities, for water districts, on down the line that have older diesel equipment that is scheduled for replacement eventually, but it's advancing that in this bill that's going to cost us money. And we as Lane County, and I can't imagine if you're Coos Curry or Josephine County, have to cut somewhere else to find the money to comply with this bill.
Do you have an estimate of the number of deaths that will happen if you don't pass the of the truck?
No, I don't. I haven't figured that out yet, but I can imagine that we are already down to mowing our right-of-ways twice a year instead of three times a year. We start getting that down to one time a year. You can imagine the sight distance accidents at intersections we're going to have. So I can't tell you definitively. Okay. I can tell you that vehicle deaths in Lane County have increased between the lack of patrol to get people to actually adhere to speed limits and the fact that we have reduced our maintenance of our roads. In addition, I'd like to mention that as an LRAPA member, the last time that EPA did a full inventory of our emissions in Lane County, for particulate matter 2.5 microns or less in size, PM2.5, which is what diesel emissions are part of, they were less than 4% of our total inventory of PM2.5. So you're dealing with a very small portion of our emissions, at least in Lane County. I think that's fairly true throughout the state. The real issue is wood smoke. And wood smoke contains polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons also, and dioxins, and many of the 40 various constituencies that you're concerned about in diesel. So if you're really thinking about having a public health impact relative to PM2.5, I suggest you think about funding a home wood stove replacement or doing something about our forest policies to prevent forest fires.
You should bring through your representatives stuff on wood stoves. I agree with you. These aren't mutually exclusive issues. The wood stoves are clearly recognized issues.
Representative Lively is already carrying a bill for us to help improve our representation on the LRAPA board for our two communities that have major issues with wood stove smoke. So I really appreciate and Representative Lively also was on the LRAPA board for quite a long time. So I appreciate that. So that's kind of, just a little bit of tie for the health side. And one more little tie. Compliance with this bill is going to hurt small business. The big guys are not going to be hurt as bad. Weyerhaeuser can afford to replace their log truck fleet. R&R King Logging out of Florence can't. So you're going to see an economic impact. There's a 2010 Columbia University study that says poverty is a larger driver of health outcomes than even tobacco use or obesity.
So you could get the evidence from Weyerhaeuser first that they would support it if we cut out the small businesses. That would be good.
You
think, Bob?
But it's kind of, here we are pushing a bill that will possibly actually hurt the small guy. And I've quite often heard people in Oregon say how important it is to support our local small businesses. So, this bill has lots of problems. As a county commissioner, it's going to make me have to decide between complying with this engine replacements and new equipment and maintaining my roads in safe conditions. And I believe that you guys should, stop work on this bill and not let it move forward.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, we've got three people that hate the climate bill.
Nope.
Representative Clem, you haven't had a shot yet.
It's a comment, not for them. I can do it while they're in transit.
Oh.
Go ahead. Comment.
I just remembered a bill from 2009 that passed requiring that all wood stoves be replaced when they sell the house with ones that meet the new DEQ1. And I remembered in particular because Representative Buell's predecessor was not excited about it, and I remember she voted no right at the end because she was worried about the effect. But we have done some things on wood stoves, but it's more as people sell their house, not date certain you replace them by.
Would you call next panel, please?
Thank you. Casey Klosterman, Shelley Bozart Davis, and I don't think we're going to have time for your PowerPoint. Okay. Joe's Asmonde.
How many more do we have?
And then after that, we have, a lot of people, but there's one gentleman from 100 miles.
And you have to destroy
I don't think we'll get to the public.
We're going to have trouble getting to other comments, so please be as brief as you can, and I'm going to ask our committee to hold the questions.
Chair Greenlit, members of the committee, my name is Casey Klosterman. I'm here today representing the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association, as well as my own company, Castle Materials. And I'm listening to you. I will be very brief.
God, I know.
We're one of the larger producers.
Health effects.
We're talking about health defects.
I will tie it for you, I promise. Okay. We're one of the larger producers of construction materials in the state of Oregon. And we do care about air pollution. I've raised five children here. I'm raising my grandchildren now. I care about it like all of you do as well, I'm sure. We also care about the economic impacts of this as well, though, which will have an effect on health.
Health effects.
As others have said. Our industry is coming out of a great recession at this point in time, down about 40% still. As we move through this process, we don't disagree with the need to look at this. What we're questioning is whether the science matches the economic benefits and whether it's been well vetted at this point in time. We would ask you to look at that carefully before you put these severely damaging impacts on our industry specifically. And I agree that there would be some greater impacts to smaller companies, most certainly. A larger company can afford the capital to do this, but does it make sense? Because the customers are actually the ones paying for it. And the largest customer is the state of Oregon. More than 60% of the work of our industry is for highways and bridges. If you're going to raise the cost of our business, you're going to repair less highways and bridges. You're going to have less economic development in the state of Oregon as a result of this if you raise the cost of our business. And again, it will affect the smaller producers.
I'm going to ask you to wrap it up.
I am going to wrap it up. But thank you, Chair Greenlink. That's what I have to say about it.
Thank you. Health effects.
Okay, thank you. And I don't have my PowerPoint, but that's okay. Chair Greenlit Committee, thank you.
Please send it to us.
I have some great graphs on there as well. My name is Shelley Bossart-Davis. I'm actually here representing our family farm and trucking business, third generation grass seed farmer, as well as our trucking company has been in business for almost 40 years. First thing I did was look into what kind of pollution we're looking at. I have those listed on that PowerPoint, but we did not make any of the most polluted lists, either by ozone, by year-round particle pollution, or by short-term particle pollution. There's a lot of lists that we aren't on, top 10s, top 20s, and according to the DEQ here in Oregon, overall air pollution in the Portland area has decreased dramatically over the last 30 years. The CEO of the American Lung Association has said we are happy to report that the state of our air is much cleaner today than when we started the State of the Air report 14 years ago. Obviously, that means does not mean that we're perfect, but we're doing really good. As far as ranking on the American Lung Association cleanest cities, Medford, Grants Pass, Bend, Redmond, Prineville, Eugene, Portland, and Salem all made that list, and that's on the PowerPoint as well. We don't have a California problem, and speaking to our trucks, we just upgraded 25% of our truck fleet, our port destination truck fleet, to 2014 Peterbilt trucks. By 2020, which is also the bill due date, I believe, we will have our entire fleet upgraded ourselves. The cost of retrofitting, you asked about buses earlier. We estimate that after talking to our own diesel mechanics as well as other diesel mechanics at over $30,000 per truck. For us, that would be about $870,000 for retrofitting, not to mention that it could be illegal to drill those holes into the frames of the trucks. You're not supposed to do that. They weren't built for that. Agriculture, also, this bill is not ag exempt. Agriculture is unique in that we only operate a couple of weeks or in some equipment, even a couple days each year. It would be too expensive to require farmers to retrofit or replace farm equipment. We talked about equipment on the road. The newest trucks are the ones that are on the road. If you talk about old trucks, those may be used 5,000 miles a year. I have a friend who uses hers 5,000 miles a year. Our trucks that are on the road that's going back and forth to the ports, that gets about 100,000 miles per year. And those are our 2014 brand new trucks. I'll wrap it up for you.
Thank you.
We'll go through. It hits home to me, not California. I have three daughters. We want clean air, and our trucking industry is doing it for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlink, members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond, a member of the IBW. Speaking today on behalf of John Mullis for the Oregon State Building Trades, roughly 25,000 union construction workers across the state. We sit here, stand here, in opposition to this bill. We stand here in opposition to the bill, but not the goal. If some of you remember, the building trades and my union, the IBW, worked with the task force put together by Margie Hoffman and the governor on the clean fuel standard. Did we take a beating on this? Damn right we took a beating, but we stepped up. But we worked with all the people together in there. I can name drop, but you can figure a lot of the big boys, okay? We came to an agreement. This, no one has approached the building trades. No one's talked about the effect of not going to work. Like the other gentleman said, we're coming out of the worst recession. And okay, I get a union check, but by extension, we here representing non-union construction workers. They have to work too, damn it. So please, we are afraid of the unintended consequences, and I wish the EIS statements would also include EIS standing for economic impact statement. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Can we have the next panel, please?
Okay. We're going to have a mixed group at the table.
All right.
Mark Nystrom.
We can handle
Chris Hagerbalmer, and Jim Geisinger.
Geisinger.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
As they come up, I think something maybe to note is I think life expectancy in the U.S. has went up, and I understand from 2010 to 2012, children born in that time, their life expectancy is actually even up, I think it was 8 weeks over that time period. So I think
I was glad to know his life expectancy at age 80 is also increased.
You are on borrowed time, Mr. Chair.
Oh, wow. Yeah, but it's a pretty good borrow at the moment. Please go ahead.
You're only 1 month over the average.
Expectation.
Go ahead. Yeah, I
think that's right.
That's life expectancy.
Chair Greenlee.
That's the first generation.
Mark Nystrom with the Association of Oregon
Counties.
Yes,
I'm
the Energy, Environment, and Land Use Policy Manager. The Association of Oregon Counties has not taken a position on House Bill 3310. However, we do appreciate the goals. Having livable communities is a priority for the Oregon counties. And while clean air is clearly important, we also need to have a viable road department. Under this bill, counties are going to incur significant costs. And already we're at a $505 million per year shortfall. So while we want to see these goals reached, we're worried about how they're going to be paid for. So my testimony is pretty short. We would like to be invited to the table for future discussions if this this discussion continues. So thank you.
If it continues, it'll continue in the Environment Committee. Check in with them.
Yes. Representative Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Chris Hagerbalmer. I'm the Deputy Director at Oregon Environmental Council, and I submitted a rather lengthy testimony, and I'm going to focus just on two health points that weren't mentioned earlier. One is that diesel is an occupational hazard. So people whose occupations bring them in close contact, including truck drivers, construction equipment operators, railroad workers, dock workers, flaggers, are all at greater risk. A recent study conducted by the California's Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment found that people working around diesel equipment were significantly more likely to develop lung cancer than those who do not work around diesel emissions. And a 2003 study found that truck drivers had an increased risk of lung and prostate cancer. And I've got some more statistics in there that are specific to that. And then when we talk about cost and benefit, so there is indeed a cost associated with upgrading this equipment. No doubt about that. But there are also public health costs. You guys all know this as members of this health committee. Families are harmed by diesel, who are harmed by diesel pollution have the direct costs of hospitalization, physician and nursing services, prescription medications, and home care. Employers bear that cost of lost productivity associated with missed work days and illnesses. And all of us, every single one of us, bears the cost of rising health insurance costs and the needs for special education and other social services. EPA has estimated that the avoided health and welfare impacts due to full implementation of the Clean engine standards. And when you extrapolate those back down, we find, so that's EPA on a national scale, and if you extrapolate those down to Oregon, we find we would save $3.5 billion in the implementation of those. So the issue is that we know that there are newer trucks out there that will come on board, but they're coming on board really slowly, because the wonderful thing about diesel equipment is that it lasts a long time and it can be rebuilt many times. And what we want to do with this legislation is really to accelerate those upgrades. And that will cost, but we have got to consider all of the benefits and costs in doing that. So I'll close there.
Thank you, Chris.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Jim Geisinger. I represent Associated Oregon Loggers here in Salem. Our association represents over 1,000 small family-owned businesses that are involved in the contract logging business. I've distributed my written testimony, which honestly focuses more on economic issues than health issues, but I will honor your request and address the health issues. In the findings of the companion bill in the Senate, the allegation is made that Oregon is ranked sixth in the country for diesel soot emissions, and I believe that statistic has been mentioned earlier today in testimony. I was kind of curious about where that came from, so I went online and I found the study that I believe that allegation was based on. It was actually done in 2005, utilizing 1999 data by the Clean Air Task Force. It was funded by some foundations whose names are pretty household, Heinz, Belden, Turner, New York Community Trust, and they had a very interesting map in there that was the basis of that allegation. This is a map of Oregon identifying the most severe airsheds for pollution, and the three that stand out, frankly, are Portland, Eugene, and Medford, and we don't log anymore in Portland, Eugene, or Medford, as much as we might like to, but we don't. We don't do that anymore. Our members live and work in rural Oregon. That's where they do their job. Some comments have been made about the risk of catastrophic forest fires. The work we do, in addition to producing timber that people use for daily needs, we do protect the forest and keep it healthy, and that reduces the chance of the large fires that can affect human health. Unfortunately, we are a very fuel-intensive industry and a very capital-intensive industry. Everything we do utilizes diesel, whether it's falling the trees, yarding them up the hill to the landing, bucking them into proper lengths, loading them onto a truck, or hauling the logs to a mill. We use a lot of diesel fuel. And the way our industry measures the worth of their companies is the value of their equipment. And what this bill would do would render a whole bunch of companies essentially worthless with one stroke of the pen, because their equipment could not be used for the uses that it was intended. So we can't escape the economic consequences of this, and I can't judge whether or not this air pollution study is accurate or not, but assuming that it is, we're not the problem. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. We're going to have to close this. I would like to, at the risk of getting scolded by the committee that's following us, if there's any members of the committee would like to make a brief statement, I'll do that. I'll allow you that before we close.
Real brief.
Representative Hayden, yes.
Thank you, Chair Greenlake. And speaking of logging, one thing that your small businesses might want to be concerned about: the federal government closed these solicitations under VIPER for the contractors that facilitate the stopping the forest fires on February 28th. And on March 3rd, they came out under OSHA regulations with some very, very strict safety standards under the rollover protection, the falling object protection, and the operator protection system. Information that I've been given by constituents and people in your arena are indicating that about 90% of the equipment that is in a third of every 3 years, all the heavy equipment fights forest fire rolls over. So a third of that is addressed this season, and about 90% has been reported to me as failing. So what are we going to do to mitigate forest fires if that equipment, and they're doing it under safety rather than diesel rules, but it requires that those equipment come up to a 2008 standard?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, it would certainly reduce our capacity to suppress fires and more importantly to prevent them in the first place. And I would also caution the committee that we're a little bit different than some of the industries that have been represented in prior testimony. A 2007 piece of equipment to a logger is pretty doggone new. It's just getting broken in. We don't replace equipment every 3 or 4 or 5 years. And there's a specific kind of equipment that we use. It's called a yarder. It's a tower. We drag the logs up the hill with that. They stopped making them in 2006. So the entire fleet of yarders in the state of Oregon would become obsolete with a strict interpretation of this bill. So as far as fires go, we'd have a reduced capacity. We certainly have a reduced capacity to deliver wood to the market. And we, in spite of all the things that has happened to our industry in Oregon, we still produce more softwood lumber than any other state in the United States.
Actually, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Let's excuse the panel, you guys there.
Pardon me?
I say excuse. In fact, I'll close the hearing on 3310, but let's continue, please.
I was just going to say, in respect, I'm glad that you're looking, if this does go anywhere, it would be to energy and environment, because Oregon has done a great job at reducing our carbon emissions. We are one of the lowest in the nation, even with the low carbon fuel standard when we put that in. We were starting 10% below where California's starting point was in the very beginning. So we are leading the nation and have some of the cleanest air in the nation right here in this state. So
our job in this bill is to make a statement as to whether we think there are important health effects to be considered. And if we do take that as a policy statement, then pass it on to environment and energy to deal with all the myriad of issues that we've heard, which I think are pretty significant. So I'll be checking in with you all to think about that.
So, Mr. Chair, first, the complication of this, I do believe there are important health concerns. The problem is they're not spread equally throughout the state, and so in addressing them, it causes different problems. So I'm going to go back to a mantra I've had since I've been here. I agree this no unfunded mandate. As I've listened to Representative Klim and you talk about previous legislation sessions and things we've done, but yet we've not implemented them fully or provided the money, I think, first, from my standpoint, we need to examine what we already have on the books and whether it's working or not, and if it isn't, how we do that before we take on another. But this concerns me simply. I believe there are, certainly in the population centers, some real health implications, but it is not spread equally throughout the state. And so, again, from the state, the state, our role in this versus how we do it, we got to be very careful, I think, of those impacts.
It's probably said pretty evenly by population.
Mm-hmm. That's
rather than by area. Yeah. Representative Bueller, I think you had a comment.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. Two take-home lessons for me from this testimony. One is, what's the real cause of air pollution and emission in our problems in Oregon? What's a major contributing cause? Is it diesel? Is it something else? And the second question is, resources are scarce, and what's the best quality-adjusted life year outcome for those investments? Is really reducing diesel emissions the best bang for those dollars, or is it mental health improvement or improving addiction treatment and other things that can really improve the health of the people of Oregon? I think that's the bigger question.
Actually, Mr. Chair, just to follow up on Representative Bueller, when I was looking at life expectancy in the U.S., one of the biggest causes right now is mental health, with suicides and everything is a bigger issue, it looks like, that we're
young
facing.
People, I think.
Yeah.
Glad we're being prepared for therapy.
I'm sorry, you're okay? I want to thank you all for coming. I know this is an odd experience, and it's odder for us every day, so I really appreciate you, and if you were online to testify and didn't get to testify, I apologize.
Work sessions?
We're adjourned.
Work sessions?
We're adjourned.